This is W2XBS. Welcome to This Week in Amateur Radio Special Christmas Edition, number 663, full version, with a release date of December 24, 2005.
Here are the stories making news this week in amateur radio.
Response to BPL complaints are an illusion of resolution, the ARRL tells the FCC. A massive BPL installation is announced for the Dallas-Fort Worth area in 2006. The Senate confirms new FCC appointees. Canadian amateurs will lose access to 220 and 224 megahertz in the new year. Hams in the United Kingdom will get new band plans when the new year starts. It's Kids' Turn at the Radio as the first Kids' Day operating event hits the air in January. Amateur Radio Vanity call sign processing will resume in January. We'll tell you when. Amateur Radio will be the subject of an upcoming radio talk program. A leap second will be added on New Year's Eve. And Congress has finally set the hard date for the U.S. to switch from analog to digital television. We'll bring you all the details.
These stories come to you in a moment, along with our regular features. Vern Jackson, WA0RCR, with the latest on upcoming contests and conventions on the Gateway 160 Meter Net Report. Chris Peterson, KG0BP, will have the latest edition of the Space Report. Leo Laporte will have all the latest technology news and commentary. Bruce Page, KK5DO, will have another update on his column on working amateur radio satellites. Bill Continelli, W2XOY, will look back in time to see what was making amateur radio history headlines. And this week we feature the late Gene Shepherd, K2ROS, with a talk from a mid-1960s WOR radio program on ham radio. That's all ahead on the special full Christmas edition, number 663, of North America's premier amateur radio news magazine of the air, This Week in Amateur Radio.
Reporting from our Northeast News Bureau in Rochester, New York, I'm Paul Kalacki, K2FX.
And at our headquarters studio facility, I'm George Bowen, W2XBS, reporting from Albany, New York.
And reporting from our News Bureau in New Brunswick, Canada, I'm Brent Taylor, VE1JH.
20 minutes of solid amateur radio news begins now.
In a strongly worded letter to the FCC, the League has once again asked the Commission to shut down the Manassas, Virginia BPL system because it's still causing harmful interference to amateur radio and otherwise does not comply with FCC Part 15 rules. Rick Lindquist, N1RL from League Headquarters, has more.
The December 19th letter from ARRL General Counsel Chris Imlay, W3KD, was in response to a November 30th letter from FCC Spectrum Enforcement Division Chief Joseph Casey. Casey suggested the answer was further cooperation between the complaining radio amateurs and the city-owned BPL system. Imlay said more meetings and discussions about ongoing interference are no longer productive, while what he called this hopelessly flawed BPL system is allowed to continue operating. Rather than producing a solution to the interference problem, the meetings have instead created the illusion that the problem is being addressed, Imlay wrote. Ham radio complaints of interference from the BPL system date back to early 2004. Previous meetings between the complaining radio amateurs and the BPL operator produced no measurable results, Imlay contended. Communication Technologies, Comtech, operates the BPL system over the municipally owned electric power grid using main.net equipment on frequencies between 4 and 30 megahertz. The League accused the FCC of not discharging its most fundamental obligation to prevent or resolve interference. It charged that the Manassas system only remains operating, quoting now, because the Commission, for political reasons, has consistently refused to enforce its rules with respect to BPL, end quote. The League told Casey that the only solution at this point is to order the Manassas BPL system to cease operation, except for interference tests. Imlay says Comtech and the City of Manassas have openly acknowledged interference to amateur stations, but claimed that until recently they were unable to notch amateur allocations because they didn't yet have the equipment to do so. Reporting from ARRL headquarters in Newington, Connecticut, I'm Rick Lindquist, N1RL.
Previous meetings between the complaining radio amateurs and the BPL operator produced no measurable results, Imlay contended, referring to the response of Donald Blaisdell, W4HJL, to Casey on December 9th. At one point in the system, interference was reported at S9 plus 40 dB on typical ham gear. That level precludes virtually all amateur radio communications, he asserted. Imlay took the opportunity to again point out that the Manassas BPL system is out of compliance with 15.615 subsection A because its operator failed to provide full information to the public BPL database by the November 19th deadline. ARRL again requests that the BPL facility at Manassas, Virginia, be instructed to shut down immediately, the league's letter concluded, and that it's not to resume operation unless the entire facility is shown to be in full compliance with commission rules regarding radiated emissions with the non-interference requirement of Section 15.5 of the commission's rules, and not in any case until 30 days subsequent to full compliance with Section 15.615 subsection A of the rules. Field tests concluded by Manassas radio amateurs established that the city's BPL system was an interference generator at distances of hundreds of feet from the modems on overhead power lines, the ARRL told the FCC October 13th. It was also incidentally determined that the system was susceptible to interference from nearby radio transmitters operating between 4 and 20 megahertz, the league added.
Newspapers in Dallas, Texas are reporting that broadband over power line internet access will be coming to the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex area in 2006. A subsidiary of energy provider TXU Corporation announced a 10-year, $150 million deal this week to build a smart power grid that will make high-speed service using power distribution lines available to millions of its customers. Construction on the smart grid system will begin early next year along TXU's 14,000 miles of transmission and 100,000 miles of distribution lines. Residential internet service is expected to start up in the second half of 2006. While internet access will be a major part of the business scheme, TXU Energy Delivery spokesman Chris Schein says that BPL is actually secondary to the overall smart grid capabilities. He says that once completed, the grid will let the company check meter consumption remotely and pinpoint problems before they become major blackouts. Proponents of the plan say BPL could be especially significant for rural areas, where traditional broadband access has lagged. Opponents fear that it will cause massive interference to all radio communications on the high-frequency bands because the power lines will act as gigantic radio antennas to transmit the BPL signal as unwanted noise and interference to nearby radio receivers. The only bright spot for ham radio was the decision by TXU to drop Amperion-based BPL and go with Current's gear and technology. Current's BPL deployment in Cincinnati has, so far, caused very few problems for the radio amateurs in that community.
The Senate this week confirmed the White House nomination of Republican Deborah T. Tate and the reappointment of Democrat Michael J. Copps to the FCC. News reports say the Senate approved the nominations of Tate and Copps by voice vote on December 21st during a late-night session. Tate, 49, most recently served as director of the Tennessee Regulatory Authority. She will fill out the remainder of the term of former FCC Chairman Michael K. Powell, which expires June 30th of 2007. Powell departed the FCC last March. A former Senate staffer, Copps, 65, has been on the commission since 2001. His new term will expire in 2010. Under Powell's successor, Chairman Kevin J. Martin, a Republican, the FCC has been operating with four members for most of 2005 and with just three members since the December 9th departure of Republican Kathleen Q. Abernathy. President George W. Bush still must fill the remaining opening on the five-member FCC with a Republican nominee to succeed Abernathy, who never was appointed to a full term. During confirmation hearings before the Senate Commerce Committee earlier this month, Tate reportedly offered few specifics on key issues facing the FCC, but touted herself as a mediator. Copps said his objective would be to help bring the best, most accessible, and cost-effective communication systems in the world to all of our people, wherever they live and whatever their status.
Transmission and production expenses for today's edition of This Week in Amateur Radio. We're covered by a grant from Chris Huber, N6ICW of Sacramento, California, where This Week in Amateur Radio is heard each week on the N6ICW repeater systems, covering all of the Sacramento Valley and Lake Tahoe regions.
Transmitting to Canada, Hawaii, Mexico, the Caribbean, and the continental United States, you are listening to This Week in Amateur Radio on the Wolke Satellite Radio Network, coming to you from windy outer space.
The Canadian Amateur Radio Service will lose access to 220 to 222 MHz on January 25, 2006. It looks like this will happen over the objections of the Radio Amateurs of Canada, the National Ham Radio Society. According to Canada Gazette Notice DGTP-004-05, the Department of Industry received strong support for this change following extensive industry debate. Hams in the U.S. lost use of the 220 to 222 megahertz portion of the 1.3 meter band almost two decades ago.
The Southgate Amateur Radio webpage is reporting that hams in Great Britain will ring in 2006 with some new band plans that will place strict regulation on the introduction of fully automatic digital communications techniques. The new band plans may also hamper growth of current automated robot digital operations by defining where on any given band they can and cannot be. While it hardly ever uses the word digital, it does refer to such things as automatically controlled data stations and defining available spectrum. For example, on 40 meters, automatic stations are confined from 7.040 to 7.043 megahertz for a total of 3 kilohertz of operating space. On 20 meters, automated data stations are given from 14.089 to 14.099 and 14.101 to 14.112 megahertz, depending on the signal's actual spectrum used by the signal. In all, automated operation is very carefully defined by specific spectrum and signal bandwidth for each high-frequency band where it will be permitted. On the VHF bands, there were very few changes except for enlarging the meteor scatter section of 2 meters and recognizing the use of other European nations of 12.5 kHz repeater spacing in the 70 centimeter band. Also, 70.150 MHz has been officially adopted as meteor scatter falling frequency on the Europe-only 4 meter band. Unlike the United States, which is looking at regulatory amateur radio operations by overall bandwidth, it appears that for now the UK and most of Europe is content to stay with the fine band segment to separate various modes. That said, in the introduction, the plan notes that on 10 meters and below, the maximum allowable bandwidth for any signal is 2.7 kHz, excluding full carrier AM, which has special dispensation for its wider audio. The new UK plan is based on one defined by Region 1 of the International Amateur Radio Union. The entire band plan is available online in PDF format at the RSGB website.
The second Sunday in January is the day to turn your shack over to the kids for some ham radio fun with a purpose. To tell us more about the special Kids Day operating event, here is Rick Lindquist, N1RL, from the ARRL Audio News.
The first running of Kids Day 2006 begins Sunday, January 8th at 1800 UTC and continues until 2400 UTC with no limit on operating time. The second Kids Day, by the way, will be Saturday, June 17th. Kids Day provides a terrific opportunity to show youngsters what amateur radio is all about, and that includes its role in emergency communication. ARRL Education and Technology Program, the Big Project Coordinator, Mark Spencer, WA8SME, says Kids Day can be a great opportunity to spark change and get kids and families thinking about emergency preparedness. While you're coaching the youngsters who visit your shack and their parents, too, on how to make contacts and new friends via ham radio during Kids Day, why not take a few moments to ask them about their family's plans to deal with emergency challenges, Spencer says in December 2005 QST. Why not use the opportunities offered by Kids Day to show the youth in your neighborhood that ham radio can be loads of fun and that ham radio is a way that they can contribute something very valuable to their communities? call CQ Kids Day when you're on the air. The suggested exchange for Kids Day contacts is first name, age, location, and favorite color. It's okay to work the same station more than once if the operator has changed. Suggested frequencies are 14.270 to 14.300, 21380 to 21400, and 28350 to 28400. Contacts via VHF repeaters are okay too, with permission from the repeater owner. Observe third-party traffic restrictions when making DX QSOs. All participants are eligible to receive a colorful certificate, which Spencer says becomes the youngster's personalized sales brochure for ham radio. Spencer believes Kids Day activities can result in a family emergency plan campaign that could save lives and future community planners who know communication and how to communicate. Reporting from ARRL headquarters in Newington, Connecticut, I'm Rick Lindquist, N1RL.
For more information on the special Kids Day operating event, visit the ARRL website and search on Kids Day.
The FCC has announced that routine processing of amateur radio vanity call sign applications will resume on Wednesday, January 4th of 2006. The Wireless Telecommunications Bureau, or WTB, suspended vanity processing in September as an indirect result of its hurricane-related extensions of certain regulatory and filing deadlines. The Commission said licensees or applicants needing relief beyond the initial extension periods should follow the process for submitting waiver requests provided in Section 1.925 of the Commission's rules. The Bureau will consider additional relief related to the hurricanes on a case-by-case basis, the FCC said on December 19th in a public notice. Earlier this year, the FCC announced it would extend filing and regulatory deadlines for licensees in parts of Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Texas, and Florida directly affected by Hurricane Katrina, Rita, and Wilma. During the extension periods, the WTB temporarily suspended certain automated licensing functions. These included dismissing applications that are returned and not amended on a timely basis, changing the status of a call sign from active to expired if a license is not renewed within the 2-year grace period for amateur radio licensees, and issuing vanity call signs. In September, the FCC said it had to suspend routine vanity call sign processing because the extensions included the 2-year grace period and could conceivably affect the vanity program.
The International Earth Rotation and Reference System Service has announced the introduction of a time step at the end of December to add a leap second as 2006 arrives. Leap seconds are needed to keep clocks in step with Earth's rotation, which varies by several thousandths of a second per day. Slowing down the clocks every year or two keeps them in sync. As 2005 transitions to 2006, Coordinated Universal Time will be retarded by 1 second. This essentially means that the last minute in 2005 will be 61 seconds long. December 31, 2005, 23:59:59, December 31, 2005, 23:59:60, January 1, 2006, 00:00:00. This adjustment will affect UTC and all timescales based on UTC. Loran C and GPS will not be adjusted physically, however. Times of coincidence for Loran C are available on the Time Service webpage. For GPS, the leap second correction contained within the UTC data of the navigation message transmitted by satellites will change. After the leap second, GPS will be ahead of UTC by 14 seconds.
The FCC is accusing a Florida ham of broadcasting in the ham bands. In a letter dated November 22nd to Miguel A. Espinoza, KD2CL of Miami, the agency says it has come to its attention that on numerous dates in October 2005, between 10 a.m. and 3 p.m., that Espinoza allegedly engaged in broadcasting on the 40-meter amateur band and on numerous occasions failed to identify properly. The letter to Espinoza goes on to note that Section 97.113 subsection B of the Commission's rules prohibits, with very limited exceptions, broadcasting and one-way communications in the amateur service. It also warned him that continued violations of Commission rules will result in enforcement action against his license. This is not the first time Espinoza has heard from the FCC. The regulatory agency says that he was issued a warning notice on October 15th of 2001 regarding broadcasting and failure to identify.
Transmitting to Canada, Hawaii, Mexico, the Caribbean, and the continental United States, You are listening to This Week in Amateur Radio on the Wolke Satellite Radio Network, coming to you from windy outer space.
Produced by amateurs, for amateurs, and originating from Albany, New York, you're listening to This Week in Amateur Radio.
The Maritime Radio Historical Society is considering having the 500 kHz band designated as a memorial frequency on the international level. Bruce Tennant, K6PZW, from the Amateur Radio Newsline, has more.
The idea is that museums and historical initiatives would be issued with coast station licenses to operate on the band. It comes as a result of some experimentation showing that 500 kHz would be ideal. The Maritime Radio Historical Society has recently been carrying out the experimental transmissions to test the viability of the proposal. The transmissions were made between the historic Morse code radio station KPH, based at Point Reyes in California, and KLB Marine Radio in Seattle, Washington. The test started with KPH transmitting a series of test messages, not long after the operators at KPH heard KLB calling. According to Richard Dillman, W6AWO of the Maritime Radio Historical Society, the KLB signal was weak, but it was a thrill to hear it. What made this contact so important was that KLB was using A2-modulated CW. This mode had, until that moment, not been heard on 500 kHz for decades. During the following hour, both stations sent test messages. The KPH test message asked listeners to phone in with signal reports. 9 people responded. According to Dillman, the test proved a great success. Now I'm Bruce Tennant, K6PZW in Los Angeles.
There is a really big event coming your way in January, and you're likely to hear it on a repeater in your own city, courtesy of the Echolink Network. What is it? Here is Amateur Radio Newsline's Tuck Miller, NZ6T, with the details.
The Missing Link, a worldwide web-based intertie system, has announced an online interview with Echolink creator Jonathan Taylor, K1RFD. The live session is slated for January 10th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Missing Link system is where ham radio and internet are united as one using Taylor's Echolink. The system is made up of multiple ham stations, including repeaters that are all interconnected to make a single global repeater. It does not matter if you are in Sumatra or downtown Cleveland. If there is a repeater or bulletin station with a high-speed internet connection, the Missing Link can bring the world of amateur radio to your backyard. For more information about this revolution in amateur radio, how to join, and more about its future plans, send an email to admin@missinglink.us, or you can visit the organization's website at www.missinglink.us. And, oh yes, the link in Missing Link is spelled L-Y-N-K. I'm Tuck Miller, NZ6T in San Diego.
In case you missed that date, it's January 10th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time for Jonathan Taylor, K1RFD's talk on the Missing Link Network about Echolink on a repeater near you.
International Space Station Expedition 12 Commander Bill MacArthur, KC5ACR, really enjoys being an astronaut, but he told students at Sanderson High School in Texas via NA1SS December 8th that he really hasn't spent all that much of his career in space.
See, I've been an astronaut for 15 years, but this is only the fourth time I've flown in space. So it's a great job, but there's much more to it than just being in space, over.
But being in space and navigating by floating around in microgravity is just really neat, he told another questioner. Still, being part of a two-person crew for 6 months aboard the ISS does put a lot of pressure on the astronauts to complete their work, MacArthur explained in another reply. Still, he made it clear that he loves being aboard the space station.
I love it in space. If it wasn't for the fact that my family and friends were on the ground, I would never want to leave, over.
10 high schoolers took part in the event, and Sanderson math teacher Amy Carmen, KD5HYB, served as the control operator for the direct VHF contact. On December 15th, students at Mount Carmel High School in San Diego, California, also had the chance to interview MacArthur via ham radio. MacArthur told the students there that most movie portrayals about life in space have not been very accurate because they don't capture what it's like to work in microgravity. He also said the astronauts and cosmonauts themselves are the most important research subjects. We ourselves are the experiments, he said. The direct VHF contact between KG6EQU and NETI-1SS ran about 6.5 minutes. Both school group contacts were arranged by the Amateur Radio on the International Space Station, or ARIS, program. ARIS is an international educational outreach with U.S. participation by ARRL, AMSAT, and NASA. Reporting from ARRL headquarters in Newington, Connecticut, I'm Rick Lindquist, N1RL.
A California resident has been arrested for selling computers loaded with bots, hidden automated programs that spew spam and other internet hazards onto the internet. This after some really good detective work by some government investigators. Amateur Radio Newsline's Jim Damron, NATMW, has the story.
The FBI has arrested a Los Angeles man whom the government accuses of creating and selling bot-loaded computers. These are computers that included software designed to launch electronic attacks and send out an uncontrolled number of spam messages. According to news reports, the 17-count indictment alleges that the unidentified suspect wrote and spread malicious computer code in order to gain control of legions of infected computers. He then sold access to hackers and spammers. The indictment charges conspiracy, money laundering, transmission of code to a government computer, and accessing a protected computer to commit fraud. Among systems infected by the programs were PCs at a Navy weapons center and some Defense Department computers.
The suspect was taken into custody last month. The government says it's the first prosecution of its kind in the nation. If he's convicted on all counts, it could mean up to a 50-year prison term.
Mission accomplished. That was the word on the 2005 holiday toy drive from ARRL Delta Division Vice Director Henry Leggett, WD4Q, and Assistant Warehouse Volunteer Coordinator Joe Lowenthal, WA4OVO, on the U.S. Gulf Coast after they'd completed unloading more than 5,000 toys contributed by generous amateur radio clubs and individual radio amateurs from all over. In addition, the second ARRL holiday toy drive benefited from more than $8,000 in cash donations, which permitted the purchase of gifts for older recipients and helped defray the cost of transporting the toys. The toys headed to Mississippi following a December 15th send-off ceremony in Memphis. ARRL Media and Public Relations Manager Alan Pitts, W1AGP, who spearheaded the drive from league headquarters, says Lowenthal, a former FedEx employee, did such a professional packing job that he only needed one truck, instead of the anticipated three, to transport the toys to coastal Mississippi from Memphis, saving even more money to purchase additional toys. The overwhelming response of hams around the country was clear, as thousands of toys, games, bikes, and stuffed animals headed south, he added. The ARRL toy drive partnered with the Salvation Army, whose distribution network throughout the Gulf Coast remains intact. The Salvation Army has the ability to screen recipients and will assure that the toys are used where they are truly needed most, Pitts explained. A big rental moving van took the full load directly to Gulfport and Biloxi, Mississippi. Representatives of the Salvation Army and the League were on hand in Memphis December 15th to see the truckload of toys southward. Holiday Toy Drive National Chairperson and country music singer Patty Loveless, KD4WUJ, joined amateur radio volunteers, the news media, dignitaries, and, of course, Santa Claus for the occasion. On January 8, 2006, amateur radio will be given coverage on the national talk show Talking with Heroes. Emery McClendon, KB9IBW, will be one of the guests on the hour-long show and will answer questions about amateur radio and the role of ARMAD, Amateur Radio Military Appreciation Day. The show highlights organizations that support the efforts of our military members and veterans. You can listen live by logging on to Stardust Radio and following the log-on instructions. For more information and times of the show, please visit the Talking with Heroes webpage.
Transmitting to Canada, Hawaii, Mexico, the Caribbean, and the continental United States, you are listening to This Week in Amateur Radio on the Wolke Satellite Radio Network, coming to you from windy outer space.
Season's greetings. This is W2XBS. I would like to take a moment to wish all of our affiliates and listeners across the country and around the world all of the best of the holiday season. And as our present to you, now that we have you all up to speed on the latest news, please sit back and enjoy one of the nation's best storytellers talk about being a kid and getting on amateur radio. Now, for your enjoyment, here is Gene Shepherd, the late K2ORS, as heard on one of his broadcasts on WOR Radio in New York during the mid-1960s.
I'm for Gene Shepherd, author, raconteur, and commentator on the contemporary scene. Here's Gene.
I remember very cleanly and distinctly the excitement that Friday night meant. It's a fantastic, it always will. Even to guys who are not in school, who are still not 15, Friday night is a special, peculiar kind of a dangerous night. And what it meant to me, I have to admit one terrible thing at one point in my life, what it really meant to me was Friday night was the one night that I could keep my ham station going until dawn. I did not have to get up early in the next morning. Even my paper route did not work early morning Saturday. The paper was not delivered on Saturday morning. I made my collections Saturday afternoon, but I could stay up all night. And I'd come home from a date, you know, the whole scene. I'd have the whole bit going. And about 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock, I'm with this girl. We're having a malt, you know. We're sitting in the drive-in watching Charlie Chan or some other big opus of the period. I can hardly wait, you know. I keep hearing it in my mind. I keep hearing the CQs on 40. I said, oh, boy, there must be. Gee, right now, about now, the West Coast must be coming in. Right about now, the W6s are starting to pound into the 9th District. And here I am sitting with Esther Jane, you know. And Esther Jacobs saying, gee, what a penny for your thoughts. And I'd say, yeah, well, a penny for my thoughts. What'd you say? What? She'd say, a penny for your thoughts. And I'd think for a minute, and I'd say, shall I tell her about that Pi Section Network I was thinking of in my mind? This Pi Section Network, I got a terrific idea to change the standing wave ratio on my 600-ohm feed on my 40-meter ZEP. Shall I tell her about that? And then it would come out, you know, and I'd say, yeah, okay. And I'd say, you know, Esther, what I was thinking of, that there is in the handbook, in the ARRL handbook, there's a terrific section on Pi Section Networks. And I wonder if you'd like to go home with me and the two of us will build a Pi Section Network that will reduce the standing wave ratio on the 600-ohm feeds to my 40-meter. And by that time, I'd see her drifting away. And she'd be looking out of the front window of the car now, and she's watching Charlie Chan again. I said, what's the matter? What's the matter? Just think of the fun we could have together. You could hold the solder, and I could take the soldering iron. And I'd say, give me the solder. Quick. Come on. Now put a plier down there. Hold it on that terminal. Psh, oh, boy, would we have fun. And it'd be this long, pregnant silence. And I recognized that once again, Mighty Casey had struck out. And I could not, I knew then there were certain things that you just didn't talk to chicks about. Pi Section Networks, you do not discuss mercury switching systems with chicks. You do not discuss a Class C final with a chick. And you don't even discuss the ineffable mysteries of the universe of that kind with a girl. And I remember one period I was plunged into a profound funk, a real funk. And oddly enough, just the other night, I'm looking in the newspaper, I'm sitting there, and I'm down at the Horn and Hardart, you know, and I got my egg cup in front of me and a big cup of Horn and Hardart's coffee, and I'm just casually going through the paper. And it was a paper that I found there. It was on somebody's table. I'm just going through it. And suddenly, Skip, a name hit me. A name just stuck right out of the headlines there. Now, we're used to big, you know, regular names like President Johnson, Dean Rusk, and Charles de Gaulle, Mickey Mantle and stuff. It was a name? I says, no, it can't be. It can't be. And it was an obituary. And sure enough, there it was, the name of a man who probably nobody in the entire Horn and Hardart, probably, I would say, anybody on 6th Avenue at that moment, sitting in coffee shops, sitting in H&H's, and sitting in Bickford's, wherever they might be, if I ran from one of those tables to the other and says, look who died. Look at the name. Do you remember the name? The name would mean nothing to them. To how many of you does the name Heising mean anything? Did you ever hear of Heising modulation? Heising modulation. You know, there aren't many men in any field who give their name to an entire system or an entire formula or a new discovery. You know, like the Salk vaccine. We all know the Salk vaccine. Dr. Salk's name will be familiar and will be famous for generations, the name Salk vaccine. We know about Freud, you know, the Freud dream analysis ideas and Dr. Freud's hypotheses and so on. We know about Einstein's theory of relativity. Well, Heising lived over here in Jersey. He died just a couple of days ago. And I caught the name, and it was connected with one of the peculiar long blue funk moments I've ever had in my life. The Heising system of modulation is a system of AM amplitude modulation. Now, you're listening to me in most likelihood, if you're listening to 710 on your dial, I know you are, you're listening to amplitude modulation. That's AM radio. The other kind of radio is connected with another man. That's the FM radio. What's the name of the man, really, who was generally credited as being the genuine developer of FM radio? Come on, who is it? What kind of an engineer are you, for crying out? You know who it is. Why, he was there. Isn't that sad? The great men of our time, hardly any, Major Armstrong. Oh, for heaven's sakes. He also was involved in the super heterodyne theories. That's another thing. There was a great man. But the name Heising, it became so mystical, so involved in my life, like a Colpitts oscillator, for example. I wonder if old man Colpitts, who invented a certain type of oscillator, knew that for years and years and years there would be a little diagram in question and answer manuals, in ARL handbooks that would say Colpitts oscillator. Now, I'm not talking to you about radio here, so don't get bored here. I'm talking to you about something else. Can you imagine your name, let's say Witherspoon or Aschenschlager? Let's say if there were textbooks to be printed for 100 years from that, and it would say Aschenschlager's Law of Rottenness. And forever and ever, people would know the name Aschenschlager, and it's not even a man anymore. It's just a name. It's a name. Heising was not a man to me, and I was astounded to find a Mr. Heising died. And I read the obit, and it was the one. It really was the Heising who had created this system of modulation. Well, let me tell you, speaking of bad modulation, this is WOR, AM and FM, New York. Now, I'm not going to go into a technical description of what the Heising system of modulation is. I could go into that. That's for next semester. We won't do that tonight, but I will tell you this, that I am now on CW. See, I'm a kid. I'm about 14 years old. I'm a ham. And my whole life is connected with this stuff. And of course, I was also involved in other things, like I'm playing football, and I'm playing second base, and I'm going out with Esther Jane Alvery, and I'm going out with Dawn Strickland, and I've got all the chicks going. You know, the whole scene is a gigantic fruitcake of existence. And connected with all of it, of course, and somehow weaving through it in this tapestry, was this thing of back home in the front bedroom, my shack. And this was my special place, my shack. You know, the day bed is over here, and the windows are over here. And the shack was a bedroom we did not use. It was my shack. And I had this old table that I had bought from the Salvation Army for a dollar. And I'd cleaned it, and I'd put formica on the top of it and polished. I had a little vise on the side of it, you know, and I had the desk drawers all cleaned out, and I had compartments in there where I had resistors and condensers, and I had all the whole scene. I had a clipboard off to the left where I kept my log sheets and my plate readings and my grid drive readings and all that. And I had a rack. I had a 4.5-foot rack that I bought. I bought it in an old used radio store, a place where you buy old radio junk, you know. And I bought this rack. It's a big 4.5-foot rack, and it had big 19 and a half inch panels across it. And in it, this big 4.5-foot rack, which is a great big piece of iron, I had a 10-watt transmitter. That was the joy, the light of my life. It was CW, and every night when all the other kids, you know, were sort of just hanging around the living room and walking around picking their teeth and crying and whining and looking out of the window and yelling down the hot air register, you know, stuff that kids do, I would be in the front bedroom in my shack with my key.
We'll be back with more of Gene Shepherd, the late K2ORS, as heard during the mid-1960s on WOR Radio in New York, after we pause four stations on the network to identify. You're listening to This Week in Amateur Radio on the W0KIE Satellite Radio Network.
The time that Uncle Tom gave me that key, I will forever remember. He gave me an old railroad, beautiful railroad key with a sidewinder, you know, a real key, see. And I would be down there at maybe 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and I'm on there with my cans, my Brandy's earphones hanging on my head, and I'm on 40 meters. My 6L6 is laying it down on 40, and I'm right there in the middle of the band. 7182 was my Bliley X-Cut Crystal. And I am number one on 7182. And my rig had such poor voltage regulation, Skip, that the entire house, when I would press the key down, the lights would go, whoo, whoo, whoo. And about every 10 minutes, my old man would come, bang. Will you cut out that? I can't even read now already. I'd say, okay, Dad, all right. I'd sit there and then I'd go, wait for a couple of minutes. I wait till, you know, you always wait till the ripples sort of die down. And the talk builds up again out there. And I go, a few little V's, you know. I am laying it out on 40. So this is my whole life. I walk around the streets with Esther Jane or with Helen Weathers or with Dorothy or one of the chicks I was going with, and I would hear a horn. A car would go past, you see. And I'd hear that old horn blow. You always hear this. If you're a real CW man, you hear it, and you can never get rid of it. You hear it all the time. I stand next to subway trains right now on 59th Street, and they come along, you know, and I hear the doors rattling and everything. And I hear them. They say things in code. He goes past roaring out of CQ, you know. It's the double A train. I can hear a CQ just as plain and easy. You know? I'm walking down the street with Helen Weathers or with Dorothy Anderson, and I hear the horns. You know, the horn goes. Some guy sends a K. I turn around and go. And there's a dull silence. Then. And then I'd hear obscenities. I'd walk along and somebody'd send an obvious obscenity. He doesn't know he's doing it, you know. He'd just say, I'd dig Dorothy. I said, you hear what he said? She said, what? And, of course, the word got out that I was kind of a nut. You know, kids who do things that all other kids don't do are always kind of looked upon as the nut, the crowd. Well, about that time, it was maybe about a year after I got on CW, and I was going up for my Class A examination. Now, this is a special exam that you take that involves amplitude modulation. It's about telephone, radio telephone, this whole business that we're involved in right now, you and I. You're listening to me on a radio set. I'm talking to you on an amplitude modulation transmitter and so forth. Well, that was that whole theory, diagrams and the whole business, and there was one special section called the theory, the adjustment, and the maintenance of the Heising modulation system. And I got involved in that. Somehow I began to dig this system. I liked to, it had a nice symmetry about its diagrams. It was a nice, somehow I dug the theory of the Heising system. Don't ask me why, I can tell you now. One thing, it's cheaper than most other systems. And I began to dig this Heising modulation system. And then I began to go down to the old surplus radio stores, and I began to look for chokes, filter chokes and stuff that I could build, I could use to make this Heising system. And it became almost the next big goal. You know, as we all live in our lives, whatever little life we have goals achieved and goals about to be achieved, and we have goals we're aiming at all the time. So a guy may live during a certain period in his life, and his idea is get a boat. And he walks around the street, and he thinks about boat. Or he may have this thing, get a promotion, get to be the chief clerk. And he thinks about this all the time. Get to be the chief clerk. Other guys at the thing, yeah, I'm going to make money on the AT&T. I'm going to make dough. You see, the reason we dig horse racing and the stock market and that kind of thing is because you can see goals achieved and also goals fail. That's part of it. And so each life, each day, is a whole series of little goals. Gee, if I can only get away to get a cup of coffee. Holy smokes, if I can only get away, get a cup of coffee. Oh, wow, wow. And you go for about a half an hour, so you're working away there, and then all of a sudden you say, I'm going to go and get a cup of coffee. And boom, the next thing you know, you're sitting down there at that good old chock full of nuts, and a coffee's out there, and a goal has been achieved. A goal has been achieved. Bing, it's big, you know. It's there, you see. And there I was beginning to develop this thing, and Heising modulation. Now, I know this means nothing to you, but millions of hams are listening, and they're saying, yeah, man, yeah. Well, at that same time, there was a girl that I was really hung up on. I don't even remember this girl's name. It was one of those brief, momentary things, you know, where you get hung up on a chick. I remember she had dark hair, and she had sort of pink, light-type skin, and I remember she lived on the north side of town. And I remember I used to ride over there about every second day with my Elgin bicycle, like mad through the gloam, just to look at her house, you know, that kind of thing. Just to ride past her house once in a while, like, hey, wow, look out! She'd never look out. But once in a great while, I'd see her at the tennis court, that kind of thing, and I had a big hang-up on this chick. And at the same time, I had a hang-up on Heising modulation. Well, one day, I'm in this store, this old junky store that we used to go to. I'm down in the Ace radio shop. It's a crummy old lousy radio shop. They have millions of piled up turntables of old disreputable types, you know, wound for Bulgarian capitals, special types of winding that only work on 6.5 volts or some nutty thing like that, or 18 1/3 volts, all kinds of crazy equipment. And I came across the transformer. It was perfect for my Heising modulation. Well, I had about a dollar. That was about as much as I could go. And old Sam, back at the counter there, at the Ace radio shop, is looking me right in the eye, and he says, a buck, are you kidding? Do you realize it's a 300-mil transformer? What are you talking about, Mac? You don't find many of them anymore. That's a 300-mil Ford Darson transformer. And I... There, I'm there, confronted with it. Well, that night, I had a date. I had $1. This son of a gun wanted 2.5 for this transformer. Now, I had probably a total stake at the time of about $3, of which $1 was to go for a transformer that day, or something else. Maybe I wanted to buy it. Whatever I was going to get, it was going to be a buck, see. I figured $2, well, we'll go down to the Orpheum, me and this chick. That'll leave us enough to get a hamburger over at Miner and Dunn's. And, well, you know, it'll work out pretty good. I'll maybe squeak by with an extra quarter or two. I had it all figured out. Well, Sam looked me in the eye. I looked Sam in the eye. And right there on that counter in front of us, it was laying right there. Now, this is the curse that all men have had to face all their time. All men I know. Is it going to be a boat? Or... Hey. Oh, yes, indeed. I don't think chicks have these kind of decisions to make quite as often as men. They may in the future. But men always have these little things, you know. They do. They have to decide whether or not to be a social animal or a rotten, crummy, selfish animal. Now, usually they devise it in such a way in their mind to be both. And so the guy will say, well, if I buy this transformer, I will be a happier person to be with. Not only that, I will be more fulfilled. And then I could certainly be able to fulfill my role with Esmeralda much. But actually, I'm investing in her, if you look at it in a certain way. If you look at it a certain way, in a certain light, that the best thing I could do for her would be to buy this 300-mil Thor Darson transformer and build up my Heising modulation system, and from there on in, it would be hotsy-totsy. That's the way my mind went.
We'll be back with more of Gene Shepherd, the late K2ORS, as heard during the mid-1960s on WOR Radio in New York, after we pause four stations on the network to identify. You're listening to This Week in Amateur Radio on the W0KIE Satellite Radio Network.
So 5 minutes later, I am going home with this big transformer under my arm. Oh, that excitement, you know. I had all the other stuff, you know. I was all ready to go. And that afternoon, I'm building and soldering, getting this thing going. You know, I got the diagrams out, and I'm working down the circuit values, and I'm hinging a little bit. You know, I got a couple of things where it says 0.2 micro-microfarad condenser. I got a 0.1, you know, little things like that all the way down. Yeah, I'll make it work, you know. The resistor that it should have been, let's say, 1,500 ohms. I had one that was 2,700 ohms. You know, that's close enough for jazz, you know. So, well, anyway, it's now about 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock, thereabouts. And I have built my first modulator. I don't know whether you know the excitement, friends. I don't know how I can transmit this to you. Of going on the air for the first time on your transmitter. Now, I'm not talking about CB. This is nothing. This is kid stuff. Come on. None of that junk. And by the way, many people today confuse amateurs for CBers. They're totally different animals, completely. There is no parallel between. A CBer bears about the same relationship to an amateur as a little grandmother riding along the West Side Highway in her 47 Plymouth bears to Sterling Moss. It's about the same, isn't it? Roughly, yeah. They ain't at all the same thing. Don't confuse them at all. And so I've got this Heising modulation system all done. I've got a 6L6 tube in the final. I got a dummy load on it. And I'm all set to try it out, test the whole thing out. I got the microphone. I got a single button carbon mic. Put the gain on, turn it all on. And then I stand back with the mic, and I'm ready to go. And I've got I was using to test my modulation system, I have a 2-watt neon bulb, which I could see, that was about as close. And of course I had a milliammeter, I had an ammeter in the plate and so on. And so she's heating up. Slowly I apply the plate voltage. I had a variac and I'm applying the plate voltage to my final. She's now up to 700 volts. That's a lot of voltage on that poor old 6L6. She's a bright, brisk cherry red, you know, and I said, well, maybe I'm going to back it down a little bit. I go down a couple of notches, and I got about 500 volts on the plate, and then I switch in my Heising modulation. And there's one moment, just a moment of pause, when suddenly, without any warning, it goes, I get this fantastic chatter in my transformer. I back it down. Wait a minute. I turn off the switches. Get out the diagram. I'm checking it over here. Check. Everything checks out. Yes, indeed. Let's see. Well, maybe I had just too much gain on the input there. Maybe she was overloading, motorboating. That's it. She's probably motorboating. So I turn it on again. I stand back and wait. Everything in my 6L6s glow, this nice cherry glow, and I turn up the gain a little bit. Hello. 1, 2, 3, 4. Hello. Hello. Ooh, for crying out loud. Back it down a little bit. Hello. By the way, Mr. Heising was doing this to me, in case you don't know it. The man who just passed into the great beyond over in Jersey. Hello. And it was the first time that I'd ever encountered one of the major curses of mankind, downward modulation. Now, that means nothing to your friends. Except suffice it to say that when old Shep talks to you here, the transmitted signal of WOR goes up. As my voice goes up, the transmitter, the signal goes up. Well, my transmitter was working the opposite. As I would talk into it, it would go down. And I'm holding the thing up there. Hello. And now it's getting about 7 o'clock, see. Hello. 1, 2, 3, 4. Oh, what a curse. And I could not get... And by that time, I decided, well, there must be something wrong. I'm not checking it right, so I'll call CQ. Hello, CQ. And I'm tuning back across. Hello, I'm on 160, in case you're interested in the van. Hello, CQ. And I stand by. And immediately, a guy comes back right on the frequency. Gung! W9QWN. Hello, fantastic signal. W9QWN. This is W9XXX standing by. Do you hear me all, man?
W9XXX, yeah, this is W9QWN here. You're Q5R9 plus here, old man. Handle here is Shep, S-H-E-P, Shep. Handle here is Shep. We're running a single 6L6, about 10 watts, Heising modulation, modulated by a single 10, by a single 6L6 here, and a single button carbon mic. I'm using a 40 meter Zeppelin carbonator tomorrow. Okay, W9XXX, W9QWN standing by. Clunk. That signal comes back. W9QWN, this is W9XXX here. I recognized him as one of the great famous hams of the area. You know, it's like talking. It's like if you're an aviation nut and all of a sudden you're hooked up with Lindbergh, you know. I mean, you're down at the flying club and you two are discussing flying together. You know? And he comes back to me and he says, what'd you say the handle was? I don't remember working you before. I just thought I'd call you. You're messing up the band. You're lousing up the frequency here. It sounds to me like you've got a little downward modulation, and I don't think you're final. It sounds a little bit like you're a lot of parasitics there. And not only that, it sounds to me just a little bit like your neutralization is way off, man. Just thought I'd call you. I didn't want to get involved in any long rag chew. You better look into it, old man. And I'm going to QRT now. I think I'll pull a switch, and don't bother to come back. You sound rotten. Don't bother. Come back, old man. It's all right, fella. Your signal here is about, I'd say, around a Q3, Q2 to 3, about an R2. Well, that meant that he had to turn up everything he had just to hear me. And when he did turn it up to hear me, I was just rotten. And so he just, boom, he's gone. I'm sitting. Icing modulation, eh? Yeah, turn it on again, I take my neon bulb. This time I put the dummy load in. See, I'm not going to radiate all over the band. And I get on there. Hello, hello. Keeps flickering downward. It's now 8:30, quarter to nine. My chick has been waiting for me since 7. It's at 7 o'clock. When I finally realize, you know, this way lies madness. In this way lies the antisocial animal. And that once you have committed yourself to the antisocial animal, forever you'll be down in some dank basement, surrounded by half-empty ball jars full of nails. The rest of your life will be given over to this insanity, whatever it is. I knew that even then, as an animal. I knew even then that hang-ups can devour you. And so, about quarter to nine, I looked at this thing, and I says, okay. I turned it off. And 15 minutes later, I am picking up this chick. And 10 minutes after that, we are on our way to the Aragon. We are on our way to this place where they had these terrible bands and stuff, see? And all the way on up, all I could think of was downward modulation. All I could think of, it was like I had failed as a man. I wonder, it's too bad that Tennessee Williams doesn't write plays about the things that really get guys going, that really get guys hung up. I have known guys for 2 solid years... 2 solid years to be eaten up inside. I mean eaten up. Where they yell at their chicks. They threaten to kill their daughters. They take a shot at their boss because of one thing. They get rotten gas mileage. They're getting 8 miles to the gallon. And it burns them up every time they go into that gas station. You know, they bought this monster and it takes 14 gallons of gas just to get to town and back. It's like Ahab and that whale, you know. And so we are on our way to the Aragon Ballroom. Well, have you ever danced with a chick when you've got a Heising system of modulation on your mind with downward modulation and also a bad problem with parasitics? All the time I'm hearing parasitics in my mind. And parasitics are awful things. They're like little, when you hear parasitics on the air, you know it. It's like a swarm of awful, angry, sort of somehow debauched, erotic locusts. They surround your signal. It's a fuzzy signal. If you could tune past WOR and it sounds like a shaving brush that's been drinking, that would be like my signal was on 160, and I'm bugged.
We'll be back with more of Gene Shepherd, the late K2ORS, as heard during the mid-1960s on WOR Radio in New York, after we pause four stations on the network to identify. You're listening to This Week in Amateur Radio on the W0KIE Satellite Radio Network.
Well, on the way home, after about, at least 4 hours of dancing, it seemed like 4 hours, went on endlessly, back and forth we're going. We're on our way home, and she turned to me, and she says, "I don't want to hurt your feelings." I said, what? Already, you see, I was back in my shack. I was sitting next to this chick in the Western Avenue car, but I'm already back in the shack, you know, and I've got an idea. I'll tell you what it is. It must be the cathode. It must be my cathode biases. That's it. I I'm thinking, I can hardly wait to get home. I'm going to change that resistor in there. I know what it is. Oh, what a fool, what a nut. And she says, now, come on. She says, I don't want to hurt your feelings, but you're one of the worst people that I've ever dated. I said, what? I don't make passes or anything. I'm a nice guy, you know. I took her out there. She said, you're one of the worst people I've ever dated. And she says, not only that, she says, but I think that your mother ought to take you to a doctor. I think you're unhealthy. Unhealthy? It never occurred to me that having a hang-up on a cathode follower circuit or having a hang-up on Heising modulation was somehow a perversion. It was a sickness. I said, well, unhealthy. I mean, I play football, all that stuff. What do you mean unhealthy? Now I'm getting a little bug with it. What do you mean unhealthy? Anybody with the kind of skin you got should holler about unhealthy, for crying out loud. She says, well, I don't care. She's bugged. Oh, a woman scorned even at the age of 14 is hell on wheels. That's all I got to say. So I'm saying, well, what do you mean unhealthy? She says, well, I don't think you even talked to me once tonight. What do you mean talk? You didn't I buy an orange drink? I bought you knee high. I talk. I said, I asked you if you wanted another one. I remember that. I said, this is fun. I remember telling you this was fun. She said, you did not talk to me once all the time we were at the Aragon. Long pregnant pause. I said, what am I going to talk to you? What do you know anything about downward modulation? She says, what? I said, well, I've got worries. I'm worried. Can't you tell I'm worried? Nothing is worried, more worried than a guy who is building something and it hasn't worked. I can tell you this, it drives you out of your skull. Because I'm worried. And we rode all the way home on the Western Avenue car in silence. Got to the end of the line, took her home, says goodbye. Just goodbye. That was the end of that. I took off like a big speckled bird. I'll tell you, I didn't think of her 8 seconds off. I'm over the privet hedges. I'm going, you know. I'm flying all the way home with my wings going, you know. Wow. Woo, up the front porch. Boom, in. Pow, into the front bedroom. Goom, goom, goom. The switches are going on. The old man sitting out in the front room there listening to the A&P Gypsies or something, you know. And I got all the switches turned on, everything going, waiting for it to heat up. I got the soldering iron heating up, and I've got the solder out there, and I have got that 2 micro-microfarad condenser, which I should have put in the very beginning in the cathode. It hit me halfway through Red Sails in the Sunset, what the problem was. Halfway through, I just, what's the matter with me? I got a 1/10 condenser in there. It should have been at least a 2 micro-microfarad. I'm soldering this thing up, you know. Boy, I heat this baby out. There, I got the microphone going. Dummy load. All right, let's see. Putting in a little grid drive there. Now she's, oh boy, she's doing real good. Ooh, ooh, bah. I tune the final plate. Ooh, what a dip. I'm tuning that final tank. Now, ooh. Advance the gain a little bit. Hello, 1, 2. Oh, what a beautiful sight. What a beautiful sight. My milliammeter in the final plate is ticking up ever so slightly. Ting, 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 ting. Up, she's working perfectly. I take my neon bulb. Hello, 1, 2, 3, 4. Hello, 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 hello. 1, 2, 3, 4. Hello. Beautiful envelope. Magnificent signal. Pow. Out comes the dummy load. In goes my 600-ohm ZEP-B. Boom, boom. I'm tuning her up, oh, man. Up to the full 10 watts. Hello, 160. Hello, hello, hello. Hello, hello. Hello, CQ. Hello, CQ. Look at that meter flicking up in there now. Look at it right behind your head, Skip. Look at that beautiful sight. Hello, hello. Hello, CQ. Hello, CQ. Hello, CQ. Calling CQ. I sat there until I was red in the face calling CQ. This is W9QWN calling CQ and listening. I developed that real snotty way, you know. And listening. Come in there. Boom. I'd wait. Of course, the band was one solid mass of heterodynes. I could hear nothing. Just whoo. All the big-timers are coming in. It's late at night. And then, finally, about 1 o'clock in the morning, I hear this guy calling. Hello, W9QWN, W9QWN. This is W8LFD in Cleveland, Ohio, calling. Hello, 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 W9. Oh, fantastic moment of total joy. You know how the guys who have reached the top of Mount Everest feel? I know that feeling. I know that feeling of standing on the top of a glacier, looking out over the Himalayas. Nothing but achievement. You can't go anywhere after this. There I sat that night, working guys all over the Midwest with my 10-watt Heising system of modulation. And it wasn't until there was a postscript to this. Years later, I am out of the Army. Years later. Oh, boy, long time afterwards. I am going through a department store. I am home about a week and a half, and I still got my uniform on. And I'm going through a department store in Chicago, and who do I meet but that girl? That same girl. And she's working in one of the big stores. In fact, she was working in Carson, in case you're interested. And there she is. And I couldn't remember the chick's name. And she couldn't remember my name. And she was behind a counter. And we both stood there, and I said, "Say, Hammond High, didn't you go to Hammond High?" She says, "Yes, of course, you, I remember you." I said, "I remember you. Do you remember the..." She says, "Yes, the Aragon." We stood there for a second. And then she finally says, "You know, you were kind of a nut. Did your mother ever take you to the doctor or something? See about that?" I said, no, that problem's all cleared up now. It's all cleared up. Little did she know that the problem was all cleared up. I was getting upward modulation.
You have been listening to Gene Shepherd, the late K2ORS, as heard on WOR Radio in New York. Happy holidays from all of us here at This Week in Amateur Radio.
Hi, Mother Radio. What's going on?
Hang on just a second, Zach. I am test driving your father's new interstellar interocitor.
Wow, that's pretty weird. What does this interstellar interocitor actually do?
The interstellar interocitor scans outer space for lost. This week in amateur radio Christmas programs, captures them and returns them to our station right here on Earth.
Wouldn't it be easier just to download this stuff off the internet?
I suppose, but this way is certainly more interesting.
Where did my dad get this thing anyway?
eBay!
Long lost amateur radio Christmas stories. That's the subject of a special Random Access Christmas coming up in just a few minutes. Right here on This Week in Amateur Radio.
Transmitting to Canada, Hawaii, Mexico, the Caribbean, and the continental United States, you are listening to This Week in Amateur Radio on the Wolke Satellite Radio Network, coming to you from windy outer space.
And now with the latest technology news and commentary from Petaluma, California, This Week in Amateur Radio is proud to present Leo Laporte.
In 3, 2, 1. Very big news for people who want free internet access, free wireless. I truly believe more and more that this is going to be, in the next few years, this is going to happen, that wherever you go in an urban area at least... And maybe not even urban, any town of, say, greater than 50,000, you will get free internet access wirelessly, you know, as you walk through town. Hermosa Beach did it, Bryant Park, San Francisco has it, and actually the city of San Francisco put out a request to internet providers to see who would be interested in providing free wireless, and late last night, Google stepped forward and said... Yes, we will give San Francisco, the entire city, free wireless at home, in a park, in a cafe, wherever you are, free wireless from Google. Now, the city hasn't said yes yet, but I can't imagine them turning Google down. And what's in it for Google? Well, they make a lot of money on those Google ads. So the more eyeballs Google can gather, the more valuable that becomes. And those Google ads work. They're targeted because Google knows what you're doing when you're on the net. So you tell them, I'd like to know more about spas. You type that search in, and what do you get? You get ads for spas, right? Those are very valuable. Those aren't just scattershot ads. Those are ads targeted at somebody who's actually interested in the product. Very valuable to advertisers. So Google's got a great model. And if this goes well in San Francisco, I have every reason to believe it's not that expensive to do. The technology now is pretty affordable and cheap. And bandwidth is cheap right now. This is a pilot, I'm sure, for Google, and they're going to watch carefully to see how it works. San Francisco is a smaller city. You know, it's, what, about 500,000, 750,000? It's very small. So it's not, you know, there's not a huge risk there. It does present some challenges. It's very hilly, and, you know, much more hilly than here. So you would have some issues. Of course, it's less spread out. It has an advantage in that it's, it's 7 square miles. I mean, you couldn't really offer the whole of the Southland free Wi-Fi. I mean, I guess you could say, you know, L.A. County. You go county by county. But San Francisco is a small area, small number of people. Except for the hills, it's kind of a perfect place to try this out. Oh, and it's obviously very computer literate. Probably most of the Google guys live there. So there's some interest. Google's in Mountain View, just down the peninsula a little ways. But there's some interest, I think, in wiring their own neck of the woods, don't you think? Philadelphia's doing it. More and more cities are. City governments are doing it. But I think it makes sense, really, you know, I mean, why burden the taxpayers with this if you can get a private industry to do it? Google ads are not intrusive. If that's all they do, that's fine, don't you think? Or do you? Do you think the city should be doing it? Should our tax dollars go to this free Wi-Fi? Certainly, there's a benefit to the city. People come, I'm pushing in my own small town, I'm pushing the local government to do this. People come to town, they open up their laptops. What they should be seeing, in my opinion, is not the T-Mobile sign-up sheet or the Starbucks sign-on page, but welcome to our town. Here's what's going on this week. Here's some deals from local merchants. Those things are very valuable, I think. That front page is prime real estate because everybody who opens a notebook sees it. If you offer free Wi-Fi universally and becomes widely known, I think there's a huge benefit to that. So maybe it should be the city fathers who are doing it, or city mothers. And again, this isn't just when you're downtown in a cafe. This is everywhere. This would go into your home. Now, who's fighting this, of course? Well, you don't have to. Yeah, Comcast, Verizon, SBC, all the companies are trying to make money providing you with internet access. But I think even they will have a chance because they'll be able to offer much faster, higher quality internet access than you could get over Wi-Fi. So this is just wonderful because for the casual surfer, somebody who's just getting email, isn't really committed to the internet, maybe still using dial-up, this will be a great boon. If you're more serious, you'll still go out and buy your DSL. You'll say, I'm willing to pay, you know, more because I want fast, high-speed wired access. That's fine. I probably would do that. I wouldn't rely on free Wi-Fi for all my internet access. But everybody would get wired that way. Everybody would have access, and I think that's very important. Next step is to get this to smaller and smaller communities and ultimately get it every corner of the country. Security experts, you know, there's a little debate now. You've heard me say many times Firefox is a safer browser, and I think one of the reasons Firefox became so popular so fast is that people realized that Internet Explorer just was not safe. But now they're saying, experts saying, well, look, you know, there have been more bugs in Firefox this year than there were in Internet Explorer. How can you say it's more secure? Well, I'll tell you how I can say. First of all, there's two kinds of security. Internet Explorer is wide open to spyware, to browser hijacking, that kind of thing, because it supports ActiveX and Active Scripting. Firefox, unless you add a plugin, does not. And those are inherently dangerous technologies. So Firefox is safer not because it has fewer bugs in it. All software has bugs in it. It's safer because it actually is weaker. It doesn't support this dangerous technology that Internet Explorer does. So that's inherent. There's nothing. That's just built in. And for that reason, it is safer to use Internet or Firefox than Internet Explorer, just for the spyware alone. But then there's this issue. Well, what about all these exploits? I mean, really, spyware is nothing compared with what could be done with this particular flaw that we're talking about right now. I mean, anybody could put a keystroke logger, a Trojan horse, all sorts of stuff on your system. Well, that's true. That's very true. But look how quickly Firefox offered an update. And yeah, there may be more exploits known about Firefox. Doesn't mean there are more holes. It means just that the open source community, because they can look at the source code, is very quick to find these flaws. And I might add, very, very quick to fix them. We don't know what flaws are in Internet Explorer because nobody can look at the underlying code. Only Microsoft can. Exploits are discovered in Firefox because they can look at how it's written. Exploits are discovered in Internet Explorer via trial and error. You would expect more holes and more fixes in Firefox. That doesn't make it a less secure browser, provided you fix it, provided you patch it. So if it is important to use Firefox. I think it is a safer browser, but it's very important if you're going to do that to patch it regularly. I mean, you have to patch Windows regularly. Problem with Windows is you're at Microsoft's mercy. If they don't release a patch, you can't fix it yourself. That's not true of Firefox. You can't. You and I probably can't fix Firefox, but there are lots of programmers out there who can. So you may hear the argument, and I get email pretty regularly when I recommend Firefox, saying, well, now, come on, Leo, you've got to admit Firefox isn't as secure as Internet Explorer. Look at all the bugs in it. Well, I disagree. Firefox is still much safer to use than Internet Explorer, with one caveat. You've got to patch it. If you see that little red button in the upper right-hand corner, press it and upgrade it. You've got to do that. Open, is ultimately, I think, more secure, but it also does raise the issue that people can't find those flaws. On the podcast radio network, I am Leo Laporte. Have a wonderful weekend. Bye-bye.
Transmitting to Canada, Hawaii, Mexico, the Caribbean, and the continental United States, you are listening to This Week in Amateur Radio on the Wolke Satellite Radio Network, coming to you from windy outer space.
Connecting to the Random Access Christmas.
I am the spirit of Christmas past. Within my realm, an archive of many things from Christmas long ago. That broken toy, those forgotten holiday cards, bits of tattered wrapping paper and ribbon, several hundred tons of discarded fruitcake. Why, even an occasional This Week in Amateur Radio Christmas Story can be found within these confines. Let us audition one. Just now.
And now, an exclusive from This Week in Amateur Radio. In the spirit of the holidays, we present A Ham's Night Before Christmas. Yet another corruption of Clement Clark Moore's classic Christmas tale, this time distorted by Gary Pierce, KN4AQ, and the Raleigh Amateur Radio Society, Raleigh, North Carolina. 'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through 2 meters, not a signal was keying up any repeaters. The antennas reached up from the tower quite high, to catch the weak signals that bounced from the sky. The children, Tech Pluses, took their HTs to bed and dreamed of the day they'd be extras instead. Mom put on her headphones, I plugged in the key, and we tuned 40 meters for that rare ZK-3. When the meter was pegged by a signal with power, it smoked a small diode, and I swear, shook the tower. Mom yanked off her phones, and with all she could muster, logged a spot of the signal on the DX packet cluster. While I ran to the window and peered up at the sky to see what could generate RF that high. It was way in the distance, but the moon made it gleam, a flying sleigh with an 8-element beam. And a little old driver who looked slightly mean. So I thought for a moment that it might be Wayne Green. But no, it was Santa, the Santa of hams, on a mission this Christmas to clean up the bands. He circled the tower, then stopped in his track, and he slid down the coax right into the shack. While Mom and I hid behind the stacks of CQ, the Santa of hamming knew just what to do. He cleared off the shack desk of paper and parts and filled out all my late QSLs for a start. He ran copper braid, took a steel rod and pounded it into the earth till the station was grounded. He tightened loose fittings, resoldered connections, cranked down modulation, installed lightning protection. He neutralized tubes in my linear amp. Never worked right before, now it works like a champ. A new low-pass filter cleaned up the TV. He corrected the settings in my TNC. He repaired the computer that would not compute, and he backed up the hard drive and got it to boot. Then he reached really deep in that bag that he brought, and he pulled out a big box. A new rig, I thought. A new Kenwood? An ICOM? A Yaesu for me? If he thought I'd been bad, it might be QRP. Yes! The ultimate station! How could I deserve this? Could it be all those hours that I worked public service? He hooked it all up, and in record time quickly worked 100 countries, all down on 160. I should have been happy. It was my call he sent, but the cards and the postage would cost 2 months' rent. He made final adjustments and left a card by the key. To Gary from Santa Claus, 73. Then he grabbed his HT, looked me straight in the eye, punched a code on the pad, and was gone. No goodbye. I ran back to the station, and the pileup was big, but a card from St. Nick would be worth my new rig. Oh, too late, for his final came over the air. It was copied all over. It was heard everywhere. The ham Santa exclaimed, "What a ham might expect. Merry Christmas to all, and to all, good DX."
The preceding was copyrighted 1996 by Gary Pierce, KN4AQ.
This is Bill Continelli, W2XOY, for This Week in Amateur Radio. Happy Holidays.
Disconnecting from... The Random Access Christmas.
Hi, this is Vern Jackson, WA0RCR, for the Gateway 160-meter radio newsletter report. And as always, our thanks to QST and Electric Radio and the staff at QST and Electric Radio for today's report. Taking a look at upcoming conventions, we have none to report on, but we do have a couple of contest events. ARRL Straight Key Night on CW takes place from 0100 Zulu to 2359 Zulu, January 1st on 160 through 10 meters using straight keys. At the beginning of each year, many operators declare a respite from the technological evolution to sending their messages by straight key. Now, categories is single op straight key. Exchange, send SKN before the signal report. Radio equipment can be any age, and you can be any age. This is an enjoyable contest, not a hard, intense contest. For further info, see page 86 and page 89 in the December 2005 QST. The Electric Radio Heavy Metal Rally on AM runs all day and night, Friday, December 30th, on 1885 kilohertz east of the Mississippi, 1900 kilohertz west, 3830 kilohertz, and 3870 through 3890 kilohertz, and 7290 kilohertz. It's a time for friendly AM QSOs using restored broadcast, military, homebrew, or any commercial ham gear meeting the requirements, such as a Johnson Invader 2000, Viking Desk KW, Globe King 500, Collins KW1, etc., and big solid-state Class E AM rigs. This includes using a solid-state exciter as long as the PA is heavy metal. Transmitter must weigh at least 250 pounds or run at least 250 watts carrier output. And for further info, see page 17 in the November 2005 Electric Radio. In this joyous time of the year filled with hope and joy, wishing you and yours a Merry Christmas and Hanukkah from the Gateway 160-meter radio newsletter. This is Vern Jackson, WA0RCR, reporting from the studios of WA0RCR in Wentzville, Missouri. Until next week, 73, best for the holidays, and happy contesting. You're listening to This Week in Amateur Radio.
As we take a look at our propagation forecast, we find that average daily sunspot numbers dropped about 5 points, and average daily solar flux was down about 3 points compared to the previous week. Geomagnetic indexes were also down. Sunspot 838 currently looks to be the most interesting as it is expanding rapidly and not quite in the center of the visible solar disk, the area where it would have the most effect on Earth. The predicted solar flux for the next few days is around 90, slightly higher than it has been recently, but only by a few points. Sunspot 838 is growing rapidly, but it probably will not emit any solar flares. Planetary A index for December 23rd through the 26th is predicted at 7, 7, 10, and 7. This Week in Amateur Radio is heard on the amateur bands around the world and all across North America on great repeater systems like our flagship repeater, K2CT, operated by the Albany Amateur Radio Association on 145.19 MHz, proudly serving all of upstate New York's Capital District.
Transmitting to Canada, Hawaii, Mexico, the Caribbean, and the continental United States, you are listening to This Week in Amateur Radio on the Wolke Satellite Radio Network, coming to you from windy outer space.
This is the Space Report, available as always at www.thespacereport.com. Now, reporting from Rochester, Minnesota for This Week in Amateur Radio, I'm Chris Peterson, KG0BP. NASA has announced that they're pushing back the launch of the New Horizons spacecraft from January 11, 2006 to January 17, 2006. A problem was detected on a test fuel tank, which is similar to the one on the Atlas V launch vehicle that will launch New Horizons, and mission controllers want to inspect the actual launch vehicle to make sure there aren't any problems there. New Horizons will still be able to reach Pluto by 2015 as long as it launches before February 2nd. If it doesn't launch after that date, it will not be able to take advantage of a gravity assist maneuver flying by Jupiter. The Japanese Space Agency has announced that it's studying the idea of making its own homegrown spacesuit. They believe that with Japanese technical know-how, they can make a spacesuit that's much lighter than current models and with upgraded functions. The actual decision as to whether to proceed will be made next year, and if they do proceed, they hope that the spacesuit could be used by U.S. astronauts going to the moon in 2018. Multiple instruments on NASA's Cassini spacecraft, currently in orbit around Saturn, have discovered the source of Saturn's broadest and faintest ring. Cassini spotted a plume of water ice spewing off the south polar region of Saturn's moon Enceladus, and contributing to the renewal of that ring. Enceladus is Saturn's version of Jupiter's moon Io and is one of the only volcanically active moons in the solar system. NASA's Institute for Advanced Concepts is seeking revolutionary new ideas to advance the vision for space exploration. Interested parties should contact NASA with their Phase 1 proposals by February 13, 2006, to be able to take advantage of NIAC grants. Researchers at Ohio State University are asking for help from amateur astronomers in a research project to study neutrinos. Neutrinos are one of the most common particles in the universe, but one of the most difficult to detect. Most neutrinos captured here on Earth come from our own sun, but some come from supernovae outside of the solar system. These researchers believe that they can determine whether a neutrino came from a supernova or from our own sun by correlating neutrino captures to supernova appearances in the sky. Since 2002, 9 supernovae have been detected in galaxies within 30 million light years of here, and over half of those were detected by amateurs. So, the researchers believe that by asking amateurs to report on any supernova findings as soon as they find them, they can go back through their data and determine whether neutrinos were captured at about the same time. The discovery that Mars may have had large amounts of liquid water sometime in its past was one of the greatest developments in planetary science ever. However, 2 new studies suggest that Mars may not have been as wet as was previously thought. The first study suggests that Mars may have been more volcanically active than it is now, and that could explain conditions there. The second suggests that Mars may have been the victim of a gigantic space impact at some point in its past, which may have resulted in some of the formations found by NASA's Mars exploration rovers, Spirit and Opportunity. According to lead mission manager for the Mars exploration rovers, Steve Squires, the study was based on the first 45 days of data returned by Spirit and Opportunity because newer data was not available to the researchers at that time. A new array of telescopes will soon be scanning the skies for near-Earth asteroids, which could pose a threat to the Earth. The Pan-STARRS system will be based on the Hawaiian Islands and will consist of 4 1.8-meter telescopes equipped with 1.4-gigapixel digital cameras. The cameras can take a picture and be read out in a few seconds while the telescopes are being retargeted. The first telescope is scheduled to be completed in 2006. The entire array should be operational by 2009. Researchers using NASA's Hubble Space Telescope have discovered 2 new rings and 2 new moons circling the planet Uranus. This ring system is much further out than Uranus's currently known ring system and is being called Uranus's second ring system. It's not currently known what's renewing these rings. However, the 2 new moons may contribute to that. Hubble also discovered that there have been significant orbital changes in many of the moons circling Uranus in the last decade. This means that the whole orbital system could be unstable and that Uranus's moons could begin colliding with each other within a few million years. An Ariane 5 GS launch vehicle carried an Indian telecommunications satellite and a European weather satellite into orbit this week. The INSAT-4A telecommunications satellite has 12 Ku-band transponders which have already been sold to Indian direct broadcast satellite companies and 12 C-band transponders. The MediaSat-9 will be the backup for the MediaSat-8, which is already in orbit. This is the second of 4 MediaSats, which will be launched to provide weather data to a multinational European weather agency until 2018. This marks the first time that the heavy lift launch vehicle has been launched 5 times within one calendar year. NASA's Stardust spacecraft is scheduled to return to Earth on January 15, 2006. Stardust made a trip halfway out to the orbit of Jupiter to rendezvous with comet Vilt 2 in 2004 and collect samples from its tail. Stardust will soon re-enter the Earth's atmosphere, becoming the fastest spacecraft to ever attempt this. The spacecraft will enter the Earth's atmosphere at 28,000 miles per hour, and the resulting fireball could light up the night sky from San Francisco to Portland. An unmanned Progress 20 launch vehicle lifted off for the International Space Station from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan on Wednesday and docked with the ISS on Friday. The spacecraft carries 5,680 pounds of food, water, air, fuel, supplies, and Christmas gifts for the crew. The Expedition 12 crew of the International Space Station is in their second month on orbit and will begin unpacking the Progress on Sunday. Using NASA's Mars Global Surveyor spacecraft, researchers believe that they may have found the failed British Beagle 2 lander. Beagle 2 was intended to bounce down to the surface of Mars using airbags not unlike those used by the Mars Pathfinder and Mars Exploration Rover spacecraft. However, the spacecraft was never heard from once it reached the Martian surface. Now, this data suggests that Beagle 2 may have landed inside a crater instead of bouncing down onto a flat plain. Patterns suggest that the airbags may have hit the crater's walls and that the spacecraft itself may be embedded in the side of the crater. And that's all I have for this week's edition of The Space Report. Please visit www.thespacereport.com for space news updated every weekday. And feel free to send me your comments, suggestions, and story ideas by email to chris@thespacereport.com. You've been listening to The Space Report on This Week in Amateur Radio. I'm Chris Peterson, KG0BP.
Transmitting to Canada, Hawaii, Mexico, the Caribbean, and the continental United States, you are listening to This Week in Amateur Radio on the Wolke Satellite Radio Network, coming to you from windy outer space.
This is Bill Continelli, W2XOY, with Amateur Radio History Headlines. 1963, the ARRL, responding to some complaints about generals being allowed on 75 and 20 meter phone, proposes an incentive licensing system. Under the ARRL proposal, generals and conditionals would lose 75, 40, 20, and 15 meter phone privileges over a 2 year period. Also in 1963, the building fund to construct the ARRL headquarters at 225 Main Street, Newington, is in full swing. The amateur population is over 200,000, but CB licenses now outnumber hams. 1964, a ham in the White House? Barry Goldwater, K7UGA and K3UIG, is the Republican candidate for president. He is defeated. Herbert Hoover dies at the age of 90. As Secretary of Commerce in the 1920s and President of the United States from 1929 to 1933, his strong support of amateur radio was invaluable. He lived long enough to see his son, Herbert Hoover Jr., W6ZH, elected President of the ARRL. 1965. The FCC comes out with its own incentive licensing proposal. General and conditional class operators would lose 50% of the 75 through 15 meter phone bands. A new amateur first class license with a 16 word per minute code speed would be the stepping stone between the general and the extra. Advanced class amateurs would not be grandfathered into the first class. Rather, they would be bumped down to general upon renewal. Oscar 3 and Oscar 4 allowed two-way QSOs via satellite. This has been Amateur Radio History Headlines with Bill Continelli, W2XOY, for this week in Amateur Radio.
I spoke about SuitSat 1 several weeks ago when the deployment was delayed. Deployment should happen in January or early February. The frequency for you to listen for SuitSat 1 is 145.99 MHz FM. There will also be an alternate frequency. SuitSat will be transmitting SSTV pictures, and the only thing you need besides your radio and antennas is your computer sound card with decoding software. The Kenwood D700E radio used for packet repeater and astronaut use will be reconfigured to take the 145.99 input and repeat it on 437.80 MHz FM. Hams are requested to refrain from using packet on 145.99 during the time SuitSat 1 is operational, as it will interfere with the crossband repeater of the D700E. For more information on SuitSat 1, visit amsat.org and read the complete story, details about this operation, and the software you need. This is Bruce Page, KK5DO.
And finally this week, on February 17, 2009, some U.S. consumers could be in for a surprise. Their televisions may go dark. Budget legislation approved by the House early yesterday set that date for U.S. conversion to digital-only television broadcast. That means TV sets won't work for those who don't subscribe to cable or satellite service, don't own a new digital-ready television, or haven't purchased a set-top converter box. Lawmakers say the switch to all digital transmission will improve emergency response and homeland security by freeing up radio spectrum for police, firefighters, and other first responders who currently share a limited number of channels. Digital signals are more compressed than traditional analog channels, so they will take up only a fraction of the spectrum space now given to broadcasters. The legislation creates a program to provide each household with as many as two coupons worth $40 each for converter boxes to attach to analog television sets so that they are not obsolete once broadcasters surrender their analog licenses on February 17, 2009, as the new law would require. The Senate and House votes were praised by the high-tech DTV Coalition, a group of telecommunications, equipment, and software companies. Some of the companies have been seeking the spectrum licenses that the broadcasters must return to the government when the transition is completed. The licenses are in high demand because they are for highly coveted slices of the spectrum that could be used to expand a variety of wireless and broadband services. They are to be sold in a government auction in 2008 that is expected to raise billions of dollars for the Treasury and to provide some money for millions of households to purchase converter boxes so their television sets can continue to work. Senate approval of a DTV hard date opens a new frontier for U.S. wireless technology development, with consumers, first responders, and TV viewers all emerging as winners. We are confident that final congressional action will write the final chapter of the DTV transition.
Many of the news and information items heard on This Week in Amateur Radio have been provided by the American Radio Relay League's ARRL Letter and Audio News Service, AMSAT, the Radio Amateurs of Canada, the Amateur Radio Newsline, Australia's Q News, the RSGB, NASA, the New Zealand Association of Radio Amateurs, amateur radio websites around the world, news sources on the internet, and the packet bulletin board systems of the United States and Canada.
Transmission and production expenses for today's edition of This Week in Amateur Radio were covered by a grant from Chris Huber, N6ICW, of Sacramento, California, where This Week in Amateur Radio is heard each week on the N6ICW repeater systems, covering all of the Sacramento Valley and Lake Tahoe regions.
This Week in Amateur Radio is produced by Community Video Associates, Incorporated. If you'd like to become an affiliate, submit news items, become one of our regular voice columnists, send us comments about this weekly amateur bulletin service, or to help support us, please write to us at P.O. Box 30, Sand Lake, New York, 12153. We can also be reached by telephone weeknights at 518-283-3665. You can reach any staff member or on-air personality by sending email to their amateur call sign at twiar.org. For program audio, archives, and other useful information, please visit our website at www.twiar.org. Our snail mail address to write us or to contribute to our support fund is P.O. Box 30, Sand Lake, New York, 12153. This Week in Amateur Radio is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike license. Visit our website to view a copy of this license. Now for the staff of This Week in Amateur Radio, this is Chris Perrine, KB2FAF, saying 73, until next week. This Week in Amateur Radio is copyright 2005, Community Video Associates, Incorporated, all rights reserved.